The Fan on Demand. It's time for the Dean of College Sports. Attendance will be taken. It's Sunday morning with David Grossman, Sportsnet
590.
The Fan.
Sunday morning it is. Doesn't feel like a holiday weekend. Or does it? Family day, but that's tomorrow. And I thought every day was family day. Statutory holiday, and I'll take it. As I'm sure a lot of people will. Sunday morning, and that's what it is now. The name of the radio program on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. My name is David Grossman. Good morning to you. We got lots of territory to cover and yet another jam-packed show with some great stories about sports, people in sport, great accomplishments, and of course got some issues too. Always have time for issues. And we're going to start off with a distance runner. Not an issue, but a great story. And when I talk about distance running, I'm talking about indoors and not chomping through the snow these days. Some parts of the country. This guy's what you say in French as très bon. Very good. He's a world-class athlete and is believed to have the fastest time for 3,000 meters indoors ever by a Canadian university athlete. Alec Genet was born in Shawinigan and he went to the University of Sherbrooke, but 2 years ago he chose the University of Guelph. Smart move, many would say. And now the number one guy who shocked the Americans in Ohio a few days ago after running a personal best time in the 3,000 meters. And it was fast. And he's joining us right now. Alex, good morning.
Good morning.
Bonjour.
Bonjour à vous.
That's it. You know, I can't do any more. Well, a few words here and there. Nice job, by the way, the other day over the Yankees.
Thank you very much.
7 minutes, 57.4 seconds. Yes, nice numbers, exactly. But I don't know. Is that considered to be fast?
Well, it's considered to be fast in Canada this season. If you look at what happened around the world, I think I'm ranked 75th, so top 100 in the world. It's okay, but it would not give me the chance to go to the world championships or anything over 3,000 meters. But it's, for me, it's really, really good because I'm a steeplechaser. So in the summertime, I go over the hurdles and for 3,000 meters steeplechase. And that is really a good step for me to compete in the summer.
I love the steeplechase. Always see the guys and gals jumping over that bar and sometimes with their face first into the water, but we'll leave that for another day. Now, this time of yours, 7:57:46, I did some homework and realized that Kevin Sullivan, who was, of course, a Canadian Olympian, ran the same distance in about 17 seconds quicker about 5 years ago. But his time, I guess, is that still the Canadian record?
Yeah, it is. It is still the Canadian record. He was fifth at the 2000 Sydney Olympics. Mm-hmm. This guy was definitely the best middle distance Canadian runner we had in the history. So 17 seconds is far, but he was really fast.
What kind of reaction did he get down in the United States when you clocked this time? I mean, what were the Americans saying about this Canadian?
Well, first, we were the only university invited, only Canadian university invited in this meet. So there was like, I think, 15 other American university. And so I don't think they were expecting to see us winning there because we came 1 and 2 in the 3K. So definitely we can challenge them. And I think they might have been surprised.
Alex, you're a two-time Canadian champ in the steeplechase.
Yeah,
and you competed last year at the World Finals in South Korea. I guess you're getting up there in age.
Yeah.
What kind of time do you need to make the Canadian team to qualify for the Olympics this summer?
Since last year, I got the A standard, which was I had to run sub 8:23. This is valid for this year's Olympics. So now I have to run 2 times sub the B standard, which is 8:32. So if I run twice sub 8:32 this season before June 30th, then I'm going to be on the team for the Olympics.
All right, we're going to be watching you March 8th to 10th in Winterpeg.
Yeah.
Thank goodness for indoors at the University of Winterpeg. Canadian University track and field indoor champs. You're a fifth-year student, last chance.
Yeah.
I guess the plan for you is to go for gold, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's no other plan for me.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Alex Genet, now the proud owner of one of the fastest times for 3,000 meters indoors, and just a marvelous performance. Merci beaucoup to him. We're going to talk about a sport that doesn't really get as much attention as maybe it should, and that is the sport of badminton. The Ontario Colleges Championship was yesterday, at least the final was yesterday, in Ancaster, suburb of the Hammer of Hamilton. I was out there to see some of the action, and I saw so many birds, you know, the plastic ones, or they call them shuttlecocks, that I don't want to see a bird for another 10 years. But it was big news for a student from Brampton who commutes, get this, he commutes every day to school in Toronto by public transit. He suits up for George Brown College, final performance in Ontario before he graduates. And Devon Reed is joining us right now. Good morning, Devon.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thank you. So let me get this straight. You came to Canada 4 years ago from Jamaica.
Yep.
You were a Jamaican junior national team champ in badminton. You competed at the Junior Pan Am Games in Mexico. You've done very well for yourself. And the plan was to go into these playoffs in Ancaster. And what you wanted to do so badly was become player of the year in Ontario.
Yes, I wanted that. I really wanted that one.
And what happened?
I did get it. I got it at the banquet on the Thursday. So it was a good motivator going into the opening day of playoffs.
Of course. And then you had a couple of round-robin matches with your teammate, Mark Wong, in the men's doubles competition. You won every one of them. And then you go into the gold medal yesterday. What happened?
Yesterday, my partner, he was Mark Wong. He was focused. I've never seen him that focused before. He was focused. I fed off of his energy and his motivation, and he was just being fantastic. So I just had to keep up with his speed and everything. So.
And you won it, gold medal.
We won the gold medal. I mean, the coaches and the halftime, they come in and they give us certain tactics. Kim Ng, Don Tai, some of those guys. Change up the tactics, tell us to relax and execute our shots, because just believe in our training and what we've done. So it was very good with the help of the coaches and my.
And then when you saw me walk in, I was the good luck charm, right?
When you come in, I'm like, oh no,
that's right, the jinx.
I'm gonna lose.
Now this was the same Mark Wong, your teammate, and by the way, you won 21-13, 21-12.
Oh, I wasn't keeping track. I was one point at a time.
I was. Now, this is Mark Wong. This is the same guy that knocked you out of the Canadian finals when he played for Humber College, I think, about 4 years ago.
Well, he didn't knock me out. He came third. I beat him. He came third, but because his school was the host, they had to put him instead of me.
So you lost out.
In the semifinals.
All right, so he switches schools, and now he's on your team, the number one, number two combo in this province. What's it been like playing with him rather than against him?
I beat him last year in the semifinals also. So I beat him last year at the doubles, and this year he's on my team. I mean, we're mature students. We put all of that behind us, come together and do what we have to do. At the end of the day, we're representing ourselves and the school, so.
Devon Reed is joining us from George Brown College in Toronto. He and Mark Wong are members of the Ontario Championship men's doubles team in badminton. Now, you started out playing singles. What made you switch to doubles?
I just trained for badminton and keep myself ready and my mind ready for any discipline. And then the coach decided at the end of the year what discipline we're going to play. So I just trained for anyone.
As a kid growing up in Jamaica, in Kingston, Jamaica, you were really hooked on the sport of soccer.
Yeah, I was.
That attracted you into doing something other than schoolwork, which I understand you're studying for exams right now. But then you had a second degree tear in your right hamstring that quickly ended your soccer career, as far as you're concerned. Can an injury like that have an effect on playing badminton? I don't think it did, obviously.
It did, actually. I couldn't do some of the movements that I had to, but I took the time off and I rested and tried to heal, which is the best thing to do when injured. Like, you don't push it. You just cope with it. You know that you're injured. Just relax and try to get it better before you go all out.
Badminton is a game of speed. I mean, you need a lot of quickness and talent, and you have one wicked serve, I'll tell you. And I saw you with a lateral move. You must have been 4 feet off the ground. I didn't want to be on the other side of the net when that bird was coming at me. Would you say, though, Devon, that there's a little bit of luck in this game too?
I think you create your own luck based on what you're thinking in your mind, like your confidence, your training. So all of that, you create it.
All right. I thought that it's just, you know, some of the way that the way those birds just drop, it's almost as if they hit a brick wall and you're expecting to go further and boom, it just comes down. Anyway, you're an Ontario champ. You're an Ontario player of the year. But now you're not finished. I mean, you wanted the dream of the MVP. You got it. You wanted the gold medal. You got that too. And now it's not over. You're going for the triple crown. You're going to BC in a couple of weeks, Kamloops. March 1st to 3rd for the Canadian playoffs. What are your expectations there?
I don't know what the players are like this year, but I know they always have a strong competition, so I just have to stay focused. I know that the win in the OCAA is excited, but I have to kind of put it in the back seat for now and go for the trifecta.
But aren't you, like, I mean, addicted to winning now? It's been one of those years where you haven't lost at all, that you want to polish the whole season off, go out, graduate, knowing that you've won everything possible this year?
It would be good if we accomplished that, but we can't fixate ourselves on the wins in the past. We have to look in front of us and see what our task lies ahead of us.
A great career at George Brown College for you in sport and specifically in badminton, going out a champion. We very much appreciate you joining us. Congratulations. Good luck in British Columbia. And I want you to bring me back something.
What do you want? Wine? I hear they got a nice winery out there.
No. I want something else.
What do you want?
A gold medal.
Okay.
You think you can do that?
I try my best. How much money you got?
No, I don't want you to go to one of those stores and buy one. I want you to earn it and win it in the Canadian College Athletic Association Badminton Championship.
All right, sir. I'll do my best.
All right. That's all we ask for. You and, of course, your teammate, Mark Wong. Congratulations.
All right. Thank you.
What a great athlete. Devon Reed, student at Toronto's George Brown College, former member of the Jamaican National Junior Team in badminton, now Player of the Year in Ontario, gold medalist as well. And we certainly wish him luck. When we come back, Dan Church is going to join us, the new head coach of Canada's national women's hockey team. Stay with us. I'm David Grossman. It's Sunday morning of a holiday weekend on Sportsnet Radio, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man.
22 minutes after 8 o'clock. Sunday morning, David Grossman's my name. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Remember the song Shop Around? It was Motown's first million-selling record. And why I say that is it's William Robinson's birthday today, otherwise known as Smokey Robinson. And the Miracles. Remember the Miracles? That's what this show is every Sunday. Well, he helped define music in Motown in the 60s and 70s, and today he celebrates his 71st birthday. And get this, after 26 years, that group, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, will be inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. It's only taken 3 decades. Interesting. What else happened on this day? Canned Cherry Coke, otherwise to some people known as perfume. And Mickey Mouse was welcomed in China. On this day many years ago. Lots more. So if you're having a birthday today, all the best. Send us some cake, and we'll participate as well. Well, 'tis the season for hockey, and playoffs underway in many rinks, including universities. It's crunch time. Basically, win, you move on, lose, and you're in trouble. Good news out of York University involving their veteran women's hockey coach, Dan Church. And Dan's joining us right now, and we're going to talk about it. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, David.
Hey, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And why I say that to folks listening, and if they don't know, is you've been appointed head coach of Canada's national women's team for the IIHF championship in April in Burlington, Vermont. You got to be thrilled.
Yeah, it's always, you know, it's a privilege and an honor whenever you have an opportunity to represent your country internationally. And, you know, for Hockey Canada and for the team and the people involved to select me, it's, you know, I feel really great about it. I'm really looking forward to the opportunity.
But, Dan, the timing's not great. I mean, this could have happened when these championships are in Europe or some faraway exotic place. I mean, you're only going to Vermont.
Well, I think, you know, it's always nice to travel abroad, and I've had the opportunity to do that in the past in different roles, whether it's with the under-22 team or under-18 team, head coach or assistant coach. But world championships in the U.S. have a good, I have a good track record there. I won the gold medal with the U-18 team there, world championship, so I'm hoping to do the same in Burlington, Vermont.
With Canada having appeared in every gold medal game for years, do you kind of feel the job to be more of a huge challenge for you now, more so than any of the other accomplishments you've already achieved?
Well, it is a huge challenge. I think the quality of the U.S. team, and you know, you can't overlook Sweden and Finland and Russia and Slovakia now are starting to come really hard. And every game, whenever you play for Canada, you know, the expectation is to win. So there's a lot of pressure there, but you know, getting to that gold medal and winning it, we haven't done it in a while. So since 2007 in Winnipeg at the World Championships, I mean, won the Olympics in 2010, but haven't had that World Championship. So there's a lot of pressure, and, you know, those are things that you look forward to as a coach or an athlete.
You've got 2 months to prepare. You've gone this route before in other international experiences that you spoke about. The objective, obviously, is to win this gold medal. What are you hoping to do this year with a group of talented young women that may be different from in past?
Well, I don't think I'm trying to reinvent the wheel or anything like that. I think really it's just getting this group of athletes to come together and play as a team. And that's the challenge of short-term competition is, you know, you have a few weeks where you can all get on the same page and everyone can understand their role and be working towards that common goal. And the trick is really getting them to play their best when their best matters the most and in a gold medal game and trying to get better every day. So, you know, I don't think I'm trying to do anything too different. Our focus is going to be on playing really good team defense, playing fast on defense and complementing the offensive skill that we have a tremendous depth and wealth of skill there and just trying to produce the best hockey possible.
You know, this country loves hockey, men's, women's, men, doesn't matter. We're infatuated with the sport, and we have to be, of course, because it's our national sport. But you mention Canadian women's names like Wickenheiser, Haley Wickenheiser, Cassie Campbell. They're familiar to Canadians. Who do you think could be our next female star?
Well, I think there's a lot of great young talent in this country. And, you know, looking at the senior national team, Marie-Philippe Poulin, who had a spectacular final game in 2010 in the gold medal. She scored both goals, and she's still a very young athlete. I think she's only about 21 years old. So, you know, she's the next kind of generation of stars for this country. And then you have someone like Megan Auguste, who's been to two Olympics now, but still relatively young, you know, just graduated from college and ready to take that big step forward. And Catherine Ward on defense, I think she plays the game with a lot of flair, you know, a product of McGill University. And I think she's someone that a lot of young defenders can look up to.
Dan, you know, there was a time when all Canadians had to do was step on the ice, and we dominated. Huge scores. The competition was weak. Things have changed now, especially with the Americans, where hockey, some say, is more popular with kids than in this country. How do you prep these women that it's going to take a huge effort for every one of them to come together to win and to beat everybody else, especially when they want nothing more than to beat Canada.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think getting them motivated to want to win is really the issue or the challenge. I think that they all want to do that. I think our history in the last few games we've played the U.S., we know that they're a good team. We know the level of play and the challenge, the obstacle that they are. I really think our challenge is just being comfortable in those moments, you know, to absorb the pressure and to really take it in and let it bring a great performance out of us and really embracing that, you know, on the day we're going to be prepared and ready to go and play as a team. So, you know, the U.S., we know they're going to be good. We're a good team. It's always going to come down to a really close and tight game. And the trick for us is just be ready for that and welcome it and have fun with it.
8 years as head coach of the York University women's team. It's game day today. You finish the season 13-13. And it's the biggest game for you and the York Lions today as well. You're on your way to Kingston. You're going to play the defending league champs. Deciding game, you won 4-3, then you lost 3-2. Some say Queens is not as strong as last year, but they're still dangerous, and especially with a top scorer. What are you looking forward from your team today?
Well, for us, you know, I think it's we really just have to come and play our game. And when we've done that this year, we've been very successful. And, you know, I think the trick in games like this, you know, elimination games, is to go and play without fear. And if you get into the trick of playing to not lose or, you know, playing the prevent defense, that the only thing that prevents you from doing is winning. So the trick for us today is to go and just get out and get after it. And no one's going to give it to us. Queens definitely won't give it to us, so we have to go and get it.
Good luck. Congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Dan Church, head coach of York University's women's hockey team and now the head coach of Canada's national women's team. A great choice by the Canadians in picking him. Let's check out wrestling and a woman who's just, I mean, she just keeps on winning and winning. I wonder what would happen if I wrestled with a woman. Anyway, Jade Parsons is from Orillia, but goes to school at Brock University in St. Catharines, and she's prepping for the Canadian University Championships, which are coming up. And she's currently ranked number one among all female university wrestlers in this country in the 48 kilos. She's on the phone right now. Jade, how you doing?
How are you?
Very well. How do you think you do wrestling me right now?
Depends on your experience and how bad you want to win.
I know a lot of people would pay you big money to hurt me.
Well, that's not part of the sport.
No, of course it isn't. Let me get this straight. You're a national level athlete in judo. Why would you consider wrestling?
I actually picked wrestling over judo because I had to pick one or the other, but just because both of them demanded so much time. And wrestling was part of varsity sports. Judo isn't. And basically, if you want to succeed in judo, you have to move to the Olympic Training Center in Quebec. And I wasn't quite prepared to do that for judo.
You must be the talk of Orillia right now. Number one in this country in your weight category. I'm going to assume it's got to be your best season in the sport after winning gold medals at, get this, 7 tournaments this year. Has to be your best season, right?
Looking back, I think this is one of my best seasons.
But there was a time when you packed this up. I mean, you said goodbye to the family and friends in Orillia. You shuffled off to the University of Regina. That's a long way to go.
And
remember that? And you won the Rookie of the Year, and you won a couple of medals. What made you decide to come back to Ontario and specifically go to Brock?
Well, I heard of Brock University through the coach. It was just closer to home, and I knew that there's good training here, better training than anywhere in the country, really. And I figured, why not come back and get better training here and be closer to home?
I got to figure out how you lose weight, and I got to learn it from you. You decided to go from the 51 category down to the 48. What made you decide to drop?
Well, part of it was naturally because I started focusing more on everyday training rather than just on mat training. And then part of it was Because it's a better challenge for me. I wanted a bigger challenge.
Is there a particular way that you wrestle? I mean, do you have a technique on the mat? I know some wrestlers who attack, and then there are others who analyze the opponent and wait for them to make the move first. Which is yours?
Well, I guess I'm considered very physical with my hands, and I pressure my opponents. But I also have my judo background, so I'm considered a thrower. And people get nervous for that, so no one really pursues me. And so that is the difficult part that I'm working on right now.
I'd be nervous going up against a competitor who's pretty good in judo, and on top of that, wrestling as well. You're likely a candidate, from what I understand, for Female Athlete of the Year at Brock University. And
hopefully.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're a pretty strong candidate as well. Now, you're off to Thunder Bay in a few days for the Canadian University Wrestling Finals.
Yeah, we leave Thursday.
Do you now block out the fact that you're a medal candidate and treat this as if it's the first match of the season?
Well, I have to put into account all the work that I did to prepare for this. And I actually build on my accomplishments throughout the year to hype myself up for each tournament.
All right, when you figure out a way in which I can lose weight and you want to wrestle with me, you drop me an email and we'll find a place and a time, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of people cheering for you on that as well. Good luck to you.
Good
luck to you up in Thunder Bay as well, and I know you're going to come through with high marks.
Thank you.
Jade Parsons, Ontario University gold medalist in the 48 kilos and a member of the dominant team at Brock University in St. Catharines. I say dominant because 5 consecutive women's championships in Ontario University. That's pretty good. We're going to take a short time out, and we'll be back with an interesting story of a middle-aged woman who is so hooked on football that she decided she was going to start up the only house league for the sport in this city. We'll tell you more. Sunday morning, David Grossman continues after a sports update on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. It's going to be a nice day, sunny. Tomorrow, too. Can't go swimming yet outside, but it's going to be nice. Holiday weekend, family day, tomorrow. Some people making this a very, very long weekend. Sunday morning on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. My name's David Grossman. Along with the team, Igor Enriquez, Dan Riccio. You can follow me, by the way, on Twitter at GrossmanFan590. You can also email me at SundayMorning@Fan590.com. But please, don't email me about something that happened last month. I got an email from this guy. He wanted to let me know of a very, very good, as he puts it, a very, very good hockey player on his team. Deserved a lot of attention for scoring 2 goals in a hockey game. 2 goals. Turns out that this player was the son of the guy who was sending me the email. And it happened in January. And what he didn't bother to tell me was that his son did more than score 2 goals in a game. He had 5 penalties. I didn't think they could have 5 penalties in a game without kicking the kid out. Anyway, that's what I was told. We're going to change topics. Tomorrow could be the start of something big for some little kid, a youngster. It's family day with the Greater Toronto Football League. Now, I know very little about this, other than it might be the first football house league in the city. And it could be attracting kids so young that bedtime is when it gets dark. I'm not so sure. Someone who is joining us now. And a woman who is the boss, and I mean the boss, of the Greater Toronto Football League, and who I'm told by her husband has a passion for football and if given an opportunity to probably confront the big honchos in this sport, would not be short of words with suggestions as well. We're going to find out. Nicole Rosen's joining us right now, getting ready for the action at the Hangar, which is located at the Downsview Airport. And good morning, Nicole. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay. I want to ask you, why, when there's so much to do in life, would a woman with a degree in criminal justice want to start a football league for little kids?
It just sort of happened that way. As my kids were playing, I volunteered, and it kind of grew to a point where I was spending a lot of time working on the program that I was with, and I was kind of, it was let known to me that there was no house league in Toronto, so I decided to give it a shot, and last year was our first season, and I think that it was pretty successful for our first go-around.
I understand you had about 100 youngsters last year. One of them is young as 7.
Yes.
Is this for boys only, or are girls invited?
It's for boys and girls. Last year we did not, unfortunately, have any girls playing, but this year we have had several girls out to our winter camp, which is currently underway, and we have signed on with a woman who is going to take over one of the Adam teams as a head coach, and her assistant is also a woman.
Is this what you would call a pay and play kind of thing? You pay money and you get a shirt and a trophy, and you get to run around with a football feeling pretty good, or is this the start of what might be, and I say might be, a CFL career for some kids someday?
I think that it's always nice to think about a CFL career, but right now we're focusing on kids that are 12 and under, so, you know, getting them active and participating in a team sport and a little bit of discipline, less video games, is sort of where our goal is at this point.
Nicole, we're talking about tackle football here for kids under 12. What kind of coaches do you have? And tell us a little bit, are they certified? Do they really know what they're doing? Or do they just stand around there, as we see sometimes at a lot of high schools, supervising?
All of our coaches are certified. We also run an in-house clinic, which should be coming up in the next couple of weeks. We also offer, for any coaches that are interested in taking any extra training, we offer to pay for that, as long as, you know, obviously we're looking for a commitment for them to at least finish the season. And we have at least one coach on each field trained in first aid.
What kind of
and
money?
All have played.
What kind of money is it costing people if they want to sign their little kid up?
For the house league, the fee, which includes all of the equipment, the banquet, trophy, player insurance, a picture, is $395, but we are running a early bird special, which ends at the end of this month. We also have a special 15% off if anyone wants to coach or signed up with a friend or sibling. And we work with the families to ensure that if their child wants to play, we will get them on the field.
What kind of reaction are you getting? I'm just curious from parents and from others right now who are usually worried about their children participating in sport and getting injured?
Well, based on last year, you know, the information is out there, and there's always the possibility that there will be an injury. The parents are well informed through the media and also just with our coaches. And to be honest, we've been very fortunate, and the majority of injuries are healed with ice, maybe a little bit of time off the field, and they're back in the game.
You know, one thing I've noticed a lot when it comes to rep sports or minor sports, coaches can easily take control of a situation. They get caught up in winning, and they tend to play their best athletes all the time. How do you, as somebody who's running this, starting out what is really nurturing a baby here, and I'm talking about a league rather than an individual, how do you confront something like this and get the message across to coaches that not only is this a business for you, but you want kids to learn the sport and to learn it well enough that they're going to get hooked on it?
Well, all of our coaches understand that the objective is developmental football and to teach teamwork, discipline. We also keep our rosters pretty small, so we don't have 53 players on a team. The House League, we top it off at 20. That way the players have an opportunity not only for playing time, but also to try the different positions to see where they like.
Interesting. Good luck tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Nicole Rosen, Program Director for the Greater Toronto Football League. You can find out more by going to gtfl.ca. Well, I mentioned something about coaching. And it's so important for a youngster, not just some slug standing there for liability reasons, to brag that sports in schools happens because someone shows up. I'm talking about people who know what the heck they're doing when it comes to coaching. And there are far too many elementary school teachers, great coaches, much better than some of their colleagues at the high school level, who don't really get a pat on the back. And one of them is joining us now. And if I was Chris Spence, the director of the Toronto District School Board, I would strip some money from a department that is overfunded and do what I could to recognize all elementary school coaches who get kids going, get them motivated. And one of them, as I say, joining us, Jeff Fulton, who teaches at J.D. Parker Public School in the city, and he coaches and spends a lot of time. Good morning, Jeff.
Morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I mean, you don't get any credit for this stuff. And I was glancing through some school websites. They need to get some people with creative ideas, some good English, and maybe from the board office to jazz up many of which are what I call some websites that look like a cat's breakfast and devote some of the attention to guys like you. Do you coach to impress some principal,
no,
you know, and gain brownie points? Or are you doing this because you get some kind of satisfaction putting in more time after your full day of teaching to see kids benefit from an opportunity?
I'm definitely putting in the time for the kids. We'd like to, at John D., we like to give them as many opportunities as we can outside the classroom. So we're spending a lot of time with them before school, at lunch, and after school, just to kind of, you know, we're in an area in Rexdale where they need a lot of support, and we're there to give it to them, and we're doing it for them.
What kind of comments are you getting, if any, from parents who see their children involved in a sport that you have coached?
We're getting a lot of positive feedback from parents. They really appreciate it. The wonderful thing about coaching where we coach is they're right there to thank us, and they come back, and especially we've seen some of our kids go on to compete at rep levels later on. So we just had a few parents that came back and thanked us this week for just doing just that.
Jeff, can you share with us a story about a youngster, and just give us the first name only,
sure,
who may have come up from a challenging situation, say at home, and sports has turned his or her life around?
Definitely. There's Jordan is definitely one of our largest success stories, and he's kind of really set the tone for our program. He's showed what happens when you work hard, and he's attributed to a lot of our championships. He's one of the hardest working students we've ever had. In grade four, he started playing volleyball, and if I started practice at 8 o'clock, he was there at 7:45. I changed practice time to 7:45. He was there at 7:30. So this kind of carried over, and now he's gone on to win 6 city championships between the grade 4 and grade 7, which he's in right now, and they've been undefeated. So it's incredible to see him.
There are some reports out that say that kids do well or better in academics as a result of participating in sport. Do you agree?
100%. They need to you know, get a lot of their energy out to get their focus, and some of them just need a chance to raise their self-esteem and have a platform where they can excel, so they feel better about themselves. And that really carries over to the classroom. You see, once they start playing and their skills improve, that they're doing way better in the classroom. They're taking more risks and really doing a better job.
Now, you're a competitive swimmer. You're a former junior national athlete.
Yes.
Are you coaching because of what others have done to help Jeff Fulton out when you were a young person, or a little bit younger, I should say? You already are young. Or has this become, you know, one of those expectations on the part of, shall I say, the principal or the superintendent or the board of education, that you're hired to be a teacher, but it's expected that you put in extra time to coach a team?
Not at all. There's no real expectations. Our administration is actually, ironically enough, has no background in sports, and they're very arts focused. So when I started coming in, and myself and Miss Brown, the other coach, when we started developing the programs, it was we were doing it because we saw the benefits of athletics, and then it grew to the administration really, you know, grasping it and supporting it. not the other way around. There was never real expectations.
I can't figure out for the life of me why boards of education are cutting back on opportunities for physical fitness and gym time. It just blows my mind away. Do you find that if kids are given an opportunity to participate in sports and physical fitness, that they would do it?
Oh, 100%. We have all the kids who are trying out for the teams. They're banging down our doors to get into the gym and stay active. And they, you know, if they're not practicing, they're begging us to practice. And I think the more opportunities we give them, the better it is for education overall.
Nice to know that they're guys, coaches, teachers, people like Jeff Fulton around helping out our young kids. We appreciate your time, Jeff. Keep up the great work. You're doing an excellent job.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Jeff Fulton teaches at John D. Parker, yet another school named after a trustee. If schools have names of people, they should be for those who've achieved great success, not named after a politician. We're going to take a time out. We're going to change our clothes, put on a rugby uniform. Our next guest coming up. It's Sunday morning. I'm David Grossman. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Prices like no other. From a club like no other. The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. It's Sunday morning with David Grossman, covering the biggest stories in high school, college, and university sports. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, you can get up and start dancing. Unless you're driving. Doesn't work. Sunday morning of a holiday weekend. Dan Riccio dancing. You got to see that. It's almost as bad as Neil Houston dancing. Oh, there's Neil. Family day tomorrow. Enjoy it, folks. Sportsnet 590, The Fan. David Grossman's my name. You can be part of our family today. How's that? Well, rugby. You ever watch the game of rugby? I mean, it's a great sport. It's for people who are physical and talented and rugged. I don't know if you want to say macho, but you can if you want. But individuals that are plowing into others and without equipment, they might have a mouth guard. But what concerns me is they don't have anything sturdy, you know, to protect the crown jewels. I mean, you know what I mean? And I kind of worry about these guys getting hurt. You know, the bloody noses I'll go for, the fractures, okay. Maybe, well, there's some concern about guys getting concussed as well. But, you know, when you get hit below the waist and there's no protection, wow. And especially the younger ones, too. Connor Trainor's joining us now. He's a member of Canada's national rugby team. The 15s and the 7s. And just before we get to Connor, an email from a listener asking if Canada's in the Olympics this summer. And I don't believe rugby is in the Olympics until 2016. But we're going to find out anyway. He's just back from the West Coast. Connor Trainor is joining us. Good morning, Connor.
Good morning. How's it going?
Very well, thank. Am I right, 2016 for rugby in the Olympics?
Yeah, we didn't get into 2012, and it's not a spectator sport either. So it'll first be in 2016.
All right. Now, the most important question. Do you ever get hit below the waist?
Not too often. It's, I don't know. I guess most people get lucky and get hit in the legs more than anything else.
Yeah, but I would imagine when that does happen, there are a lot of words which you can't repeat on this radio station. The one you can say is ouch. But
it's
you
true.
Say,
it makes you question playing the game.
Yeah, you wonder whether you want to even play this game anymore, right?
Exactly, yeah. Makes you really think about it.
How easy, or was it easy, for a guy like you, a rookie, to make it to Canada's national team?
It's definitely a tough couple of years that had to be put in. Just kind of came up through the junior Canada ranks. So it was a pretty good system to get into the national team, but it definitely took a lot of hard work.
I was reading that you were one of the smallest kids in grade school, physically. And then you got bigger, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. You must have eaten your morning cereal or something like that. But what gave you the perseverance to make a national rugby team when some would say the odds were heavily against you?
I guess when I just started playing, it was just to hang out with friends and have a good time. And yeah, I'd be one of the smaller guys, so I'd be getting killed out there. But then I just grew a lot. So going from one of the smaller guys to one of the average, if not bigger guys, makes a huge difference, makes it a lot more fun as well.
Connor Train is joining us, member of Canada's national rugby team. Now, you played rugby at high school and then at university. You've also played at the provincial level, the national level. You've probably played the sport in your dreams as well. Which one did you get an appreciation for the sport more? What I mean, your knowledge for it, your determination, as I said earlier, to excel. Was it at the high school, university, provincial, or national level?
It's definitely at the high school level. Just Vancouver has a pretty big rugby scene, so you'd see tons of the national team guys around, and you'd really want to be one of them. So, they'd come out to camps, out to practices, let you know that it can be done to get to the national team. So it's definitely a lot of help, and it's just the big thing.
I understand that if I mention one word, that really tends to motivate you a lot. And that word is underdog.
Underdog.
Am I right?
It's definitely been called that from time to time. As a Canadian team, we're always going to get the underdog card. We play most teams that are ranked above us.
What do you prefer more, the game of sevens or 15s?
I think the game of sevens is just more fun, and it's a lot better spectator sport, so most people enjoy watching that more, and they'll actually understand the game, unlike 15s, where it just seems like organized violence to most people.
Organized violence.
Organized violence is the way you could call it.
You went from being the dominant player at the University of Western Ontario, now renamed Western University, to reality, I guess some would say, at the national level. Better athletes, better coaching. How difficult was this kind of adjustment for a guy like you?
Yeah, it was definitely tough going from being the top player to one of the bottom players. At the start with the national team, I wasn't even dressing for games. But slowly kind of worked my way up to being a bench player and eventually a starter for some games. So, it was a huge change, but just worked hard at it.
You've played for the under-20s against Wales and Japan. You're also still on the Western squad. You also play, I understand, out in BC with the old boys. You probably get time to do something somewhere else other than just rugby. But what I'm fascinated about, and before we wrap up this segment, I want to ask you, you scored two tries against the All Blacks New Zealand team, the number one team in the world. How good is that rugby team? We see it on TV. We read about it. We hear about it. You actually played against them. Do you think Canada can someday reach that level?
I definitely wouldn't be playing the sport if I didn't think we could eventually get there. But it was definitely an eye-opener to see just how good they are. I know how hard I've worked to get where I am, and those guys were just cutting us apart at times. So I hope we get there at some point. We're going to keep working. But, yeah, they're an outstanding team.
I'm sure we will get there one day if we have players like you, Connor. You're an outstanding athlete. We're proud of you. Congratulations. And also, protect those crown jewels.
Of course. I will do.
Connor Traynor, member of Canada's national senior men's rugby team, and a fabulous player. We're going to go to the pool now, or swimming. And our next guest, get this, she's been a treasure, and I say that, and she's heard it many times before, because that's her last name. Byron McDonald, one of the smartest swim coaches in this country, spoke highly of Vanessa Treasure and what she could do in the pool. And you know what? You never question Byron, because he's right, and usually all the time. And joining us now, just days before she heads to La Belle Province, to Montreal, for the Canadian University Swim Finals, the treasure chest of swimming at the University of Toronto, Vanessa Treasure. How you doing, Vanessa?
Good, how are you?
Very well. You've heard those lines before, I'm sure.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, the treasure chest, and she's just treasure and all that golden and stuff like that. Lots of attention for you last year as Rookie of the Year. You were an All-Canadian, you were an All-Star. But this season, something special. watching you in the pool, right? It's just been a fabulous year for you. OUA Female Swimmer of the Year, 4 individual gold medals, 2 in record-breaking time, as one as I think you also had one in a relay event, too.
Yeah.
But the best one, tell us about the best one, the 200-meter backstroke. Or was
breaststroke.
It the breaststroke? There it is.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I had really wanted to be under that 230 mark this year. So Byron kind of put me in it, and he was like, let's go see what we can do, because I'm not sure that I'm going to swim it this weekend at CIs.
Why?
So, yeah.
Why aren't you going to swim it?
Because I also swim the 200 butterfly, and they're back-to-back.
Oh.
So he's the mastermind, and he'll decide points-wise and stuff which of the two I swim.
But what you didn't tell us was that this 200-meter breaststroke, you shattered the record that was around for 18 years.
Yeah, that was super exciting. I actually didn't know until I saw it written on the heat sheet. And I thought to myself, like, I had already swam fast earlier this season, like, not rested, not in a good suit. So I was excited about that. I thought I could go and give it a try.
Well, you know what Byron's like now, right? Since you've already hit that 230 mark, and to be exact, 229.90.
Mm-hmm.
The expectations now at the Canadian Championships in Montreal is that you're going to do even better.
Yeah. I don't know. I do fairly well with the taper, so I get to come down and rest a bit going into that swim meet, so we'll see if I can go faster than that.
And I understand.
I think I can.
I think you can, too. I think, well, it doesn't matter what I think. But, Vanessa, from looking at your resume here, not only are you in the breaststroke, you're in the individual medley, you're in the fly, you do them all, and you do them all well.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it the breaststroke is number one?
I don't know. When I first started, the very first final I ever made was in breaststroke, and then I kind of have switched around. Like, for a little bit, I did backstroke when I was maybe like 14 or 15. And then it kind of, I don't know, it just came full circle.
You've improved your times by 10 seconds. 10 seconds.
I know, unreal.
I mean, you think about it, it's unbelievable. Is this like natural athleticism on your part, or is it just training and training and training?
I don't know. My old coach, when I swam for the Mississauga Aquatics, like, he had told me, he's like, I wouldn't say you are the most naturally talented swimmer, but I mean, I work really hard. And this year I did a lot of stuff in the weight room, and I feel like that really helped my breaststroke.
Not only cutting the times, but these are all personal best times.
Yeah.
And this really is something exciting. That usually happens over a course of years, or, you know, at the end of the season. You're putting up these numbers like pretty damn early.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this year the thing that I did most different was the weight room stuff. So we did a lot of stuff. I got a new weight coach, and he's awesome, and that really helped me out.
How does a swimmer pick Usain Bolt as their top athlete? Tell me that.
I don't know. I really don't know. I like his character. Like, he gets up there, he does what he does, and then he has a little charisma with it. So I really don't know. He's just a phenomenal athlete.
Share with us the experience, what it was like getting picked for the World University Games in China, and then tell us what happened.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so in that race, when I qualified for it, I was fifth at the 150-meter mark, and then I was second. I finished second. And there was a thought in my head that the first-place girl wouldn't go. So all along, I'm like, hey, maybe I get to go to China. And then I actually got to go. And when I found out I was getting to go, I did like a little dance and I called my parents. It was pretty fun.
Well, if you were in studio, we'd ask you to do the dance for us, but you're not here. Do you get the feeling at times, Vanessa, that you spend more of your life in water than out of water?
Oh, all the time. I feel much better in a vertical, like in a horizontal position than in a vertical. I'm not very good on land.
Well, I'm a swimmer. Mind you, I'm not as good as you are. Maybe one day you'll teach me some of the techniques of being a dominant swimmer and an outstanding athlete. Both of them for you.
Sorry, go again.
You'll think you'll do that again? One day you'll teach me how to be a dominant swimmer?
Oh, for sure.
All right. Well, it's great having you on the show, and we wish you well, and we thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
The treasure at U of T, Vanessa Treasure. And what a feel-good story. Like, I mean, an outstanding swimmer, only in her second year at the University of Toronto, with the national finals in a few days and having just had one banner year in the pool. We're going to swim out. How's that for this segment? and ask you to stick around. Someone special coming up after a sports update on Sunday morning with David Grossman on SportsCent 590, The Fan. Minutes after 9 o'clock. It's a beautiful day for the middle of February. Sunday morning, holiday weekend, Monday, family day. SportsNet 590, The Fan, David Grossman, my name. Hope you're enjoying the show. Our next guest, an Olympic and a world champion. Absolutely thrilled to have one half of the Canadian ice dance team of Scott Moyer and Tessa Virtue with us this morning. We have the fantastic, the eloquent, and the best-looking member of that team, too. Tessa's on the line. How are you, Tessa?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you?
Very well. You have this contagious, great personality, and what a delight it is to have you on, and we appreciate you fitting us into your schedule as well.
Oh, well, thank you. That was quite the introduction. I'm happy to be on.
Well, if you have any extra tickets for the World Championship, you'll let me know, okay?
And okay, then, they have your name on them.
The disappointment, though, at losing the International Skating Union Grand Prix in Quebec to the Americans, to people you know, Merrill Davis, Charlie White, in December, and then coming right back a few days ago and winning the Four Continents Championship in Colorado Springs over them, putting you back on top. Is this something we're going to see going back and forth?
Well, you know, there has been a bit of that back and forth, especially now that we've competed a full season, which is great. I mean, we're so happy that we're healthy, we're training well, you know, we're happy to be competing, and we're gaining this momentum as the season continues. It's hard to believe we're already heading into the World Championships, but, you know, Marilyn and Charlie are a fantastic team. They have two great programs this year, and like you said, we see every day how hard they work. So it's definitely been a rivalry, and I think it makes it interesting kind of going back and forth.
The change in rules calling for what they call more dancing. Do you like it? I mean, does it impact on your program a great deal?
Yeah, the rule changes certainly make a huge impact on our programs. I think they place pretty heavy restrictions on what we can and can't do. Choreography-wise, I think it limits the creativity a little bit, but that being said, it does add to the athleticism, and I think it really adds to the difficulty.
2 years ago, and you remember the date very well, February 22nd. You remember it, remember?
I remember it, yeah.
Yeah, the Olympics. You and Scott became Canada's and North America's first ever Olympic ice dance champs, and now 2 years, and we're looking at Sochi. When do you start feeling the pressure as a defending champs to go out there and kick some ass again?
Well, I don't know that it's pressure, at least not yet. Maybe in another 2 years we'll feel that if we're competing. But it's amazing that it's been 2 years already since Vancouver. And I think we've grown so much as athletes and as people, too, since then. I look back on those pictures and just think, oh, my gosh, we were little babies. And heading into Sochi, I mean, it's hard not to feel that. It's hard not to feel that excitement, that buzz. We'll be watching the London Games closely this summer, and I'm sure that will add to it. It's exciting.
Tessa Virtue is with us. I'm sorry, part of Canada's ice dance team who competes with Scott Moyer. They're the 2010 Olympic and world champs. I interrupted you there, but I wanted to get this. I mean, I worked on this thing. I think I understand that there's a routine called the goose. This is when you get on the back of Scott, your knees are bent, he's skating, your hands are stretched, and then you do this flip and you jump off, as amazing as it sounds, and you land. I mean, where did the idea come from? Who came up with that?
Our coach, Marina Zueva, actually saw a picture in a ballet magazine, and it was stationary, but I'm not quite sure it was exactly our move, and we thought it was impossible, but she just kept persisting and wanted us to try it, and of course it took quite some time to get it onto the ice and to get it feeling comfortable, but we're not doing it in our competitive programs anymore, but that seemed to be one of the things that people remember from Vancouver.
I got to admit something to you right now. One of the senior citizens with the pink sweatshirts that show up at every event, I'm sure you've seen them. One of them is my cousin.
And really?
She's a figure skating fanatic. I mean, she's already
got...
Yeah, she's got the seats for the Worlds in London next year already.
Great.
You know, back to what I wanted to really find out. I'm going to assume that you're fully recovered from the stress fracture suffered a year ago. Or does that something that still gives you a lot of pain?
No, well, I'm feeling great. I'm 100% training well, competing without any pain, and that's just such a joy. I think, you know, I don't take it for granted anymore, just how much it means to an athlete to have your health. I'm feeling great, and I'll be happy to give an extra wave to those ladies in the pink sweaters.
Scott and you met 15 years ago. Do you ever get tired of partnering with the same guy?
I don't, because you never know what you're going to get with Scott. You don't know what's going to come out of his mouth. And he always keeps me on my toes because, you know, he's funny. And I think the longer we work together, the more I appreciate his humor and his passion for skating.
So many highlights for you, Tessa. I mean, you look back at all your accomplishments and even the biggies like the Olympics and the World Championships. Is there one that stands out for you personally, the one that maybe someday you're going to write a book about and that's going to be at the top?
Well, it's hard not to think about the Olympic Games that way. I mean, standing on the podium in our own country, hearing the national anthem, it just doesn't get any better than that. But that being said, there are so many moments in training where we have our best programs or our best elements, and or we're just breaking down in the middle of the ice laughing hysterically. So, I mean, there are so many moments like that collectively, you know, make for great memories.
Do you get the feeling, along with Scott, that not only do Canadians love your dedication to this sport and also the success, but that as Canadians, we expect you to win everything all the time?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we receive such support from Canadians, and I think we expect to win. I mean, Scott and I, that's what we enter every competition hoping for. And, you know, I think any skater is the same. You go to win. So we have that expectation on ourselves, but I think we've come to realize that we have to skate for ourselves. We love our programs, and we have to just go out and kind of create this little bubble and stay in our zone and, you know, skate for the right reasons and not let all that extra pressure get to us.
You know, you're an athlete. I don't have to tell you that. People know that. But do you put extra pressure on yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm a perfectionist, and we're in a sport where you're striving for perfection, but that doesn't really exist. There's no such thing. So it's a bit of a daunting task, and it can eat away at you sometimes. But, you know, I think I do. I definitely add the extra pressure. And to be honest, I think any athlete in our position would.
You know, there's something that's called passion, and there's also something that's called pizzazz. And I'm wondering if you need them both to do well in sport.
I think so. At least ice dancing, that's for sure. I mean, that's part of that second mark we get. You know, you have to keep people interested. It has to be entertaining. It's the whole package. It's not just that athleticism, but it's the costuming. It's the music. It's the nuances in the programs. And I think that's what gets people watching figure skating.
Do you still have those first pair of figure skates that, you know, family bought you a long time ago and how you got started in the sport? I'm sure you must think about whether you have any movies or videos or stuff like, and looking back at little Tessa Virtue and tripping all over herself, and here she is now, an
well,
Olympic champ.
It's really funny. I have some great pictures because my mom is a fantastic photographer, and I think my brothers took me out to teach me how to skate, and I was on these little Canadian Tire hockey skates. And I was a bit of a bruiser, so I don't think anyone imagined that I would be figure skating for a living one day.
There's got to be a lot of discussion that goes on between you and Scott in preparing for a competition to make sure that, I mean, you rely on him, he relies on you. You both got to be absolutely perfect to pull it off. Do you worry about that every time, or is it something that you both now know each other's moves so well, like the back of your hand?
Well, we're still learning, and I think we're still getting to know what works for us at competitions. We're getting a little bit better at it, but it's amazing just how much communication goes on. I mean, the entire week we're away for a competition, we are constantly talking about the feelings we want to create on the ice, how we're going to help one another, what we want to portray, what kind of thoughts we'll be thinking in certain elements. We're constantly talking through those things, and you know, whether it's on the bus to the arena to perform well.
Well, congratulations on your success and for giving so many young females interested in skating something to admire. Congratulations.
Thanks so much, David.
Tessa Virtue, who along with Scott Moyer make up the best in the world at ice dance, and they're Canadians. Well, we're going to switch over now, and joining us is Mike Downey, who is the CEO and the president of Tennis Canada. We're absolutely thrilled to have him on the air with us at this time. Mike, how are you?
I'm good, David. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Some impressive numbers when we talk about tennis. We look at the success of this sport. Close to 5 million Canadians claim to have played the game this past year, which represents an increase of 23% since 2008. Who did all this research, and what does this mean to somebody like you?
Well, we do this annual tracking study nationally every June or July, and it's done by Charlton Marketing, a Toronto-based firm that actually has a lot of experience in sports research. The numbers are very important to us because we are a metrics-driven organization, and therefore we want to know where our sport is with respect to participation and fan interest. And so we were ecstatic that the results were so positive on both the participation front and the fan base as well.
What's been your biggest challenge since you took over the job as CEO for Tennis Canada?
Oh, I think the challenge, there's many of them, but, you know, one is to make sure this sport is growing, and obviously we're just a federal body, so there's many different groups that partake in growing the sport. And one of the key areas is how to get more kids playing the sport, because we determined through this research a few years ago that the average child didn't start playing tennis until 13, and that's far too late. And it was largely because kids were being coached in regular-sized tennis, and it was just too difficult for them to succeed. So we've been promoting a sport called kids tennis, progressive tennis, which is smaller rackets, softer balls that don't bounce as high, and what we'll call right-sized courts. And it is making a difference. Our research is saying that average age is coming down for young kids and picking up the sport.
But kids are also distracted by things like video games, and there's just so much that's submerged on the minds of these young kids. And there's also this perception that when it comes to tennis, Mike, that it's seen as a sport for the elite, and yet tennis aligns well with Canada's diverse culture. I can't figure it out.
Very much so. You know, it's part of our history. And, you know, to a certain degree, a lot of the sport is played in private clubs, which is great. But one of the things that we want to make sure we get across is that, yes, it is an all-access sport. It's played in parks and recs around the country. And as you said, the research clearly shows that the sport actually from a participation and a fan base end actually aligns really well with the changing diversity of this country. And that bodes well for the future here for our sport.
60% of Canadians call themselves tennis fans. How many of them do you think were still fans after the recent Davis Cup upset?
Oh, I think if we were doing the research right now, that number's gone up. And, you know, we think a lot of our success from a sport end last year was rode with the ATP and the strength of the sport, but also Milos and the great run he had last year. And the fact that we had a World Group Davis Cup tie in Vancouver last week that was on national television on Sportsnet, that would have helped grow the sport further, despite the fact we lost to France. But quite frankly, we weren't really expected to beat the fourth-ranked country in the world, the perennial champions. But we went into it confident that if all things went well, we had a good chance of upsetting them. Unfortunately, it didn't happen.
I was watching, and I saw Milos in to replace Vasek Pospisil. Curious on whose decision it was to not play Vasek.
Well, I think in the end, it comes down to the captain, which is Marty Lirondo, and he takes everything into consideration. And I think in the end here, and I'm guessing because I haven't talked to Marty since the tie, but I bet Milos really wanted to play. And when your star player wants to do something, you hand him the ball. And I think in that case, Milos felt comfortable going into doubles. And it wasn't the best match for him, but I think a lot of it was that his knee started hurting, and that led to him pulling out on Sunday. So, you know, I talked to his coach after the match, and he just said, look, his serve wasn't on, his returns weren't on the way they normally were, and it was because his knee was aching.
Everyone's concerned about economics. You know, when you look at costs and budgets, how do you grow the sport of tennis in Canada? And you develop world-class players when the number of our indoor facilities are just so limited.
David, it's a good point. There's only 120 indoor facilities in this country. Toronto has quite a few, and Montreal has quite a few, but even the major markets don't have enough coverage for the population size. And we have some provinces like New Brunswick who do not have indoor facilities, and it's very difficult to grow the sport if you can't play it 12 months a year. So we need the indoor facilities, and we need more public indoor facilities. What we're doing as an organization, we started a few years ago with what we called a new facilities advocacy committee. It's led by our chief operating officer, Derek Strang, and it's a board committee. And what it is doing now is consulting on about 20, 25 projects across the country, helping people raise the money or do some of the work around the project work around new facilities. But we're also willing to put our money where our mouth is, and we'll invest in these projects in two ways. One, we'll provide seed money. So with all the right conditions, we want to make sure that people are doing the right exploratory work. So we'll invest, I think, upwards to $20,000 for people to do engineering, to do some research, some early feasibility, as long as we get the material back. And the reason we want it back is we want to share that with other projects down the road, unless it's confidential information. But more importantly, we'll invest in public facilities. We'll put money into public facilities.
Always great having you on the show, Mike. Thanks very much for helping us promote tennis. Mike Downey, CEO, President of Tennis Canada, and of course you can watch Milos 4 o'clock today on Sportsnet TV as he goes for the championship in San Jose of the SAP Open. Coming up after a break, a three-time Paralympian medal recipient, one of the world's most predominantly, well, let's just say a successful athlete, visually impaired, middle distance runner, facing a personal injury lawsuit right now for crashing into another runner on the morning jog on the Rideau Canal in Ottawa. Stay with us. It's coming up next, Sunday morning with David Grossman on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We got about 15 minutes to go until the top of the hour. That's 10 o'clock. It's going to be a nice day today. Sun again tomorrow. A little chilly, but what do you expect? Sunday morning with David Grossman. Sportsnet 590, The Fan. We've had a great show, and we're going to wrap it up with another great guest. You got to listen to this story, and tell me at Twitter, GrossmanFan590, or you can email me at SundayFan590.com. What's wrong with this scenario? Canadian Paralympian medal recipient Jason Dunkerley. I mean, he's been blind since birth. Has won numerous medals for his talent as a middle distance runner. And he's being sued, along with his brother, for $350,000 in a statement of claim filed by jogger Mimi LePage, or LePage. Pick the one you want. She says that she had to have hip surgery after she collided with Dunkerley on the morning of January 24th, 2010, 2 years ago plus. And she's claiming to require treatment and therapy for the rest of her life, citing all kinds of tears of the hip and injuries to an elbow and a shoulder. None of the allegations have been proven in court. And Jason Dunkerley is on the phone right now from Ottawa, where we thank him for his time to talk to us about this and a lot more. Jason, good morning.
Good morning.
So what do you make of this?
It's pretty shocking for all of us. Not something any of us are really, you know, used to dealing with. A group of us were on a run in January 2010, like you said, and, you know, this collision occurred with a couple of people in our group. Initially, the woman was shocked and pretty upset, but everybody got up and continued on their run. She did, and we did, and then kind of 2 years later, my brother and I and the Ottawa Lions and the other group members are being issued with statements of claim. So we're pretty shocked for sure, but we've had amazing support from the running community here. And the sad part is, as far as guide runners, many of the people in the group had functioned as guide runners in the past, and do a tremendous service, you know, to help visually impaired runners. And so I just really hope that people don't feel discouraged to be involved in guide running, because visually impaired running is very safe, and, you know, we've always had safe experiences. So, you know, just want to reiterate how safe it is.
I get the feeling that you weren't this snotty guy that laughed and joked and anything, that, in fact, you apologized to her for bumping into her.
Oh, yeah. I mean, after the collision, I actually wasn't involved in the collision. It was two of our other group members, but they certainly apologized, and no one ever wants to see anybody, you know, obviously get hurt, or, and you know, we hearing that she has, you know, been hurt, everybody feels bad about that. But at the same time, you know, the extent of the injuries that are being claimed is just, we're not sure about that, especially because the woman did, you know, participate in a road race about 3 months after this, you know, collision took place, and there are online results and online pictures that show that. So we're just not sure about the extent of the injuries and you know, after what happened.
But you had a guide, and I guess it begs the question, did the guide not see the collision was about to happen?
The people that were directly involved in the collision were right at the back of our group. So the group, all of us, passed the woman and her friend, the other two at the back of the group were you know, just, you know, behind. And it seems that the woman kind of moved over at the last minute, and the collision was somewhat unavoidable. So it happened quite quickly. And on the canal, it's a narrow stretch of you know, road, and you know, frequently there are a lot of runners out there, and it is narrow, so passing can be, you have to be careful for sure. And I know the guides, you know, are always extremely careful, and I've been running there for years and never had any incident, and my brother also. So, you know, it was one of those things that happened, and you know, everybody feels bad about it, but at the same time, you know, the extent of these injuries that are being claimed were, it just seems, it seems over the top.
You were saying that you never had any incidents. 7 years ago, you and a friend were hit by a vehicle during, I'm told, a rainstorm. And
that's
Ottawa
right.
Police ruled that it was an accident. You suffered a leg injury, also a fractured skull. Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to return to competition?
It took me about a year. I was really fortunate. You know, I was very lucky with the way I recovered, and also had some, you know, great rehab, physio, I had a knee scope, which, you know, corrected. I had a tear in the meniscus, and I was able to bounce back pretty quickly, and I also had some great coaching. So I was able to be back within about a year. My good friend, Stu McGregor, it took him a lot longer. He had a compound fracture and had some post-operative infection. So he's actually at the point now where he's, you know, starting to really get back to where he was before the accident, but it's taken him years, you know. And, you know, we're both aiming towards making the Paralympic team this year.
Jason Dunkerley is our guest. Is Canadian, he is a Canadian Paralympian athlete, and he's won numerous medals at the Olympic and Pan Am Games. He's been blind since birth. You and your brother, I'd like to put you in a category that's called elite runners. Aren't you supposed to somehow, and you tell me how, figure out, without your eyesight, that you have to provide a clear path for others and not risk harm to them?
I think everybody assumes responsibility when you're out there. I mean, I do, my brother does, any blind runner. And also it's trust between, you know, the blind runner and the guide runner. So you assume responsibility, and you recognize that accidents can happen for sure. And, you know, we're careful out there. We're listening. You know, I think our hearing is arguably as good or better than most, because we're paying attention. So, and especially in a place like the canal, you know, where there are a lot of people around. And I would say that the guides are also paying probably more attention than usual, because you're looking out for two people. So, you know, the group that we were with, we've all known each other for years, and I've run with all of those guys. I've been guided by all of them, and my brother's run with quite a few of them as well. And And they're very careful. So, I mean, we understand that there is responsibility, and I think it's something that everybody took seriously and takes seriously still.
I'm looking at this scenario, and I'm trying to say to myself, how does something like this get resolved in an amicable way, you know, and prevent this episode from, I guess, having people shake their heads and wonder and question and fume and point fingers?
I think it does have pretty big implications, you know, not just for us, but, you know, for blind runners and those people interested in getting involved in guiding, and also, you know, for big running groups out there, you know, like the Running Room and other groups, for people to, you know, to be careful and look out for each other. And but the one thing I will say is that, you know, a lot of people have been pretty shocked to see, you know, see the news about this, and we've had tremendous support, and I'm really, really, we're all really appreciative of that, because I think people recognize that, you know, we're out there, we're running, we're conscientious, all of us, you know, as blind runners and guides, and sometimes, you know, unfortunately, things do happen despite your best efforts, you know, and but the support has been tremendous, and, you know, we're lucky to be part of such a great community here of runners.
Jason Dunkerley, you competed in the past three Paralympic Games. In the 1500 meters, you won a silver in Sydney. You also won a silver in Athens, and you got a bronze in Beijing. What kind of time do you need to qualify to make it to London, make the trip, and be part of the Canadian team?
We need to run 4 minutes and 16 seconds to qualify for the 1500 to get what they call the elite standard. And that's based on a percentage of the world record and a percentage of championship results from the previous major championships. So we've been having a great year. We've been doing some indoor events.
Where are you and your brother now as it relates to 416?
So my brother actually he's a sprinter, so he's a 1, 2, and 400-meter runner.
Okay.
So he is part of the 4x1 relay team, and he's trying to also qualify on his own in the 400, actually. So so we compete in different events. But he's, you know, he's looking pretty good to you know, qualify for London. He's just getting over a little bit of an injury right now.
And what about you?
And for me, I had an Achilles injury last year, but since about, you know, the summer, things have been really turned around. I'm working with a new coach, and we've been making some great steps. So we've been doing some indoor races. And
what's your best time right now?
Just ran a 4:08 last weekend indoors. So unfortunately, we can't use the indoor times for qualification. We have to do that outside. But
I'm sure you'll get it.
We're hoping to in April. So
yeah, I'm sure you'll get that time. Thanks, yeah. Jason. Hope everything does work out for the best. And we appreciate you sharing the story with us.
Really appreciate it, Dave. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Jason Dunkerley, Canadian Paralympian athlete. Sad story about what he has to face now. We're going to pack it up, move on, put this baby to bed. Thank you very much for listening. You can catch the show on podcast. Check my blog, both at www.fan590.com. Follow me on Twitter at GrossmanFan590. Family day tomorrow. Family number one, folks. Igor Enriquez, Dan Riccio, our family on Sunday morning on the production side this morning. My name's David Grossman. Have yourself a great day and a great weekend. We'll see you in 7 days. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan.